Did you get out much?
Did you get out much?
Into the big wild world.
So the first summer, well, in fact, every summer I did co-pilot flights around Halley. So we flew out to various nunataks and things, which was great because that was saying rock, so that was very exciting. Then I also went on some field trips. So sometimes we went to the Windy Caboose, which was down by the creeks, went camping at the Hinge Zone. But the best trip I went on was in my final summer when I flew to Rothera for the weekend. That was terrific. And that was the most exciting thing at the whole time, because you've got to imagine being at Halley for 2.5 years. You're basically, you know, it's flat white ice as far as the eye can see every day. And so then in my final summer, Steve came, Steve the base commander, what was his surname? I can't remember now. Said to me that there'd been a default develop on one of the twin otters. So they had to fly it to Rothera to get it looked at. And would I co-pilot the flight with Andy Allsop? And so I said, yeah, that would be fantastic. I think that was the best day of my life ever. We took off from Halley and we flew about 6 hours across, around the Weddell Sea, really, over the peninsula. And, you know, we got up to whatever it was, 15,000 feet. And Andy said, you know, have you ever flown a plane before? And I said, well, I've done a few co-pilots with Les. And he said, oh, well, it's dead easy. You know, here's the compass, you know, point in this direction, off you go. And I must have flown for ages. It was wonderful, really wonderful. And one of the best bits was flying, as we approached the peninsula, the air had obviously flown over a mountain and formed these giant lenticular clouds, huge, almost sort of spherical ball of clouds, but kind of lumps, and they looked like giant white Christmas trees. And I remember flying around these sort of almost giant round spherical Christmas trees that were just unbelievable. And then as we approached the peninsula, obviously it was just amazing, because much as I love Halley, you know, it's flat and white. So it was great to see the mountains. And he flew around a bit and, you know, saw icebergs and the mountains. And then we landed at Rothera, which was like paradise. They had salad. They had animals. They had rock. They had plants. I felt like the country bumpkin cousin, you know, wandering around going, oh, shells. Oh. Lettuce. Oh, it was great.
The otter had a fault. I mean,
that didn't worry me at all. I was very, I think,
by the way, co-pilot's plane, there's something wrong with it.
Yes, I don't remember what the fault was. It was obviously quite minor just to fly across.
That sounded like an excuse for a trip, actually.
A bit of a jolly, maybe. Cheer me up. Maybe I'd been looking a bit glum.
Some of the things you had to pick up, skills you had to develop whilst you were down there, was learning how to do flight following. I guess, is this hot air? This is balloon.
No, this was aeroplane. This was for the comms. So, in my first year, Mark Ryan was the comms communications officer. But obviously, being in Antarctica, you know, everyone's got their job. But should one of you disappear, vanish, die, whatever, you always need, you know, you need backup people, don't you? So I volunteered to be the reserve communications officer just in case something happened to Mark. So he taught me how to work all of the radios and the telex machines, plus all the emergency satellite phones and all that, how to set that up. But the best thing was he taught me how to do the flight following for the aeroplanes, just in case. And in fact, also just, you know, when the first planes are coming in, it's quite tiring to do flight following. So sometimes I would take over from him. So, you know, we learned how to do all the signals and pass information and I don't know, all that sort of thing. So that was great. You know, so it's like doing air traffic control, I guess, at Halley for a couple of planes anyway. I really enjoyed that, actually. It's good fun.
And emergency satellite phones, you had to learn about those as well.
Yeah, so they were kept down.
They were just
in the
coming
garage.
In, I guess, were they?
Oh, I don't know. They'd been around a couple of... I don't know when they'd arrive, but it was all stored down at the garage, again, just in case the main accommodation building went up in flames or we had to evacuate for whatever reason. So it was all stored down the garage. So every so often we had a, you know, what do you call it when you have like a siren goes off and you have to all evacuate and that, you know, a kind of trial
drill,
that's right. And we'd all have to pile out of the building, you know, go down to the garage and we'd all have jobs. So somebody would go over to the pit, they changed the names of the buildings while I was down there. So the SSB stroke Piggott building, that was where the emergency generator was. So a whole load of people would go off and do that. And then Mark and I would go down to the garage and set up all the emergency comms equipment. and test calling Bass HQ and that sort of thing. And then I used to use it as a test as well to call my mum. So that's quite nice. That was a treat.
How often were you in touch with home 10 years ago? Were there direct phone lines by then?
No. So what we had was we had an email show. No, there was a phone, but it was tremendously expensive. So I only phoned at high days and holidays. We also had an email schedule twice a day. And when I first arrived, there was a kind of limit to the amount you could write. But actually, for some reason, I think they bought more bandwidth on a satellite or something. But anyway, by the end, you could send emails pretty willy-nilly. Although, you know, didn't send that many. So they got internet eventually, but it was after I left. So I had pretty good communication.
So being in touch with Mum was still a rare treat?
Yes, yeah.
But there was mail, I guess, in both directions?
Emails, backwards and forwards.
Airmail.
And then airmail coming in with the first plane in whatever it was, October, November. And then obviously with the ship as well, a whole load of things came down. So. And of course then we had the midwinter phone call as well, you know, the the radio message, you know, when everyone said
calling Antarctica.
Yeah. That was great. Weird. It's a weird moment.
Why?
I don't know. I found in Antarctica it was best to just kind of imagine that Britain was this weird dream going on somewhere else and focused down, you know, my life was in Antarctica. And it's really strange when you hear news or you hear stories or you hear about people back because they don't seem real anymore. It seems like a dream. And, you know, I remember everyone listens to the radio recording and there's a kind of almost a sort of silence and people are almost a bit kind of like, oh, you know, and you don't really want that. So then, you know, you try and cheer yourself up by having a few drinks and a slap-up meal and stuff. But it's
so the reaction to the radio, the half-hour radio programme, was quite sort of melancholy.
Subdued, exactly. Subdued and melancholy. I think everyone's just really, you know, reminds you of all the people at home and, what, you know, I don't know. It wasn't my most favourite thing of Antarctica. So.
Did you follow world news? Again, that was also, kind of mentioned it, so some FIDs did and some FIDs didn't want
to. Yeah, no, in fact, I remember when I first arrived, we used to get a kind of newsletter thing that was sent out of kind of news, a news bulletin. And for the first week or couple of weeks, whatever, you're scrutinising this thing every day. You know, Mark Ryan used to print it out and put out these things and there'd be loads of them, everyone would be reading it. But as the weeks went past, as the months went past, you just cared less and less. Mm. And you knew less and less about what was going on. And eventually he'd just print out one version a week and people would sort of vaguely have a look at it. Because you just don't care anymore, do you? But one of the funniest things that happened when we were down in Antarctica was Big Brother started, you know, on television.
I do.
And we read about this and we thought this was hilarious. So we'd read about it, you know, a group of people stuck in a house, given challenges. And because, of course, everyone spends the whole time in Antarctica thinking a fly on the wall documentary would be awesome. So we read about these people in the Big Brother house and we just thought, you know, they've got it easy compared to us. And we just thought, how crazy. But anyway, they were.
Yes, I can see the parallels. Yeah. Absolutely. Apart from flying to Rotherhill, you also did some terrestrial field trips.
Yes.
One of which I wanted to talk a bit about was going with Dave Routledge to the Hinge Zone and the Archberg.
What was
the Archberg? You're the first person to mention this.
Oh, okay. So in fact, I looked up the same trip in my diary earlier. It was in 1999. So I'd arrived and it was still the summer season and I went out on the first field trip of the season. In the summer still. So Dave Routledge was the wintering GA, and in fact he left that summer. But he was notorious. He must have been in his 50s, but he was the fittest person I've ever come across in my life. And he was notorious for taking people on field trips that were real, you know, get up at the crack of dawn, force march across the icy wastes, Stu Murray, Abseiling, no slacking, you know. So myself, who went, was it Kevin? Kevin O'Rourke and David, the generator mechanic. Oh, what's his name? Dave. We called him Tiny Dave. Everyone has nicknames, obviously. So the four of us went out and, oh, that's right. Dave, which is hilarious. So one of the other things that I discovered later that winterers did, obviously, was they used to collect frozen, you know, you'd have dinners for a week before your field trip and people would take frozen food out with them so they'd have proper meals. There was none of that with Dave. You know, you were living out of your man food box and that was it. You might take a few pots of satay sauce to cheer it up, but it was all done the old school. So we went down to the Hinge Zone. Beautiful weather, of course. It was still I don't know, when was it? February, so it's still lovely and warm. So the two boys from the other tent and Dave and I were in this one. And so we would go out on the skidoos or go hiking every day. And the two features that we particularly visited was Archberg, which was a berg that was in the shape of an arch. And it must have been around for at least a year or so before we arrived, because people were on the base were still talking about going and visiting it. And it was a beautiful, we have loads of photos of this beautiful arch. But I think by the time I left, I think by my third summer, or the last field trips, it had gone. So it was very temperate. It was in, you know, the hinge zone, obviously, which is where it was moving around a lot. So, but the other thing we went to was Stonyberg, which I'd forgotten about, which was and obviously an iceberg that had scraped along the bottom of the sea, picking up stones, and then flipped up. So it was studded with little rocks and pebbles. And that was quite exciting because, again, rocks, pebbles, quite unusual. So these are the two places we'd went to. And gosh, I remember the boys moaning. Dave Ratledge would take us out and he'd be stomp, 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 and the rest of us would all be like, you know, dying at the back. Anyway, about 3 or 4 days into the field trip, Dave and Kevin went on strike. They said, we're not going for a walk, we just want to have a relaxing day in the tent. So Dave said to me, oh, well, do you want to go for a walk, Alex? I was quite tired, but I thought, why not? You only live once, don't you? So the two of us went out and we had the most lazy day in the world. He didn't storm off, he leisurely strolled around. He'd obviously roped up to me. That was the problem, you see, being roped up to Dave Routledge, you had to keep going. But he, because it was just the two of us, and, you know, he was obviously in a good mood, and I'd said I would go. So we just had a lovely stroll around. We stopped for a picnic, we had nice chats, we had a lovely day together. And the next day the boys joined us and off we went again, hurtling across the hinge zone. So but that was a beautiful field trip. It was lovely, lovely and warm.
Did the penguins live up to expectations?
Oh, they were magnificent. So we used to go down to the creeks. I don't know if other people have explained, but there was a place called the Rumples, which was just south of Halley, which was rocks that were poking out. I don't know if they actually came above the sea level, but anyway, the sea ice used to go over them and then break up and form these cracks in the shelf that would then fill up with snow and form these ramps. And it was brilliant, of course, for relief. But we used to go down and camp on next to a creek, so it was like Creek 3, Creek 6, and then we could walk down onto the sea ice and see the penguins. And I think my favorite trips were when we went down and stayed at the caboose, and you know, when it was sunset, you know, obviously, which lasts for weeks, and the sky would be beautiful and you'd get these beautiful emperor penguins out there and the chicks and things. At first, I didn't know how to behave with the animals. You know, I used to get too close and scare them a bit. And I remember Ian Marriott saying, you know, Alex, don't get too close, you know, you'll alarm them. But, you know, I mean, they were just as curious about us, really, because obviously they hadn't seen anything else. And we saw some Weddell seals. They were beautiful. And then I saw one time we went down to N9. We were doing a drum raise. And we arrived on the sea ice. And again, this was one of my all-time favourite moments. I can't remember who else was on the trip. Jim Fox was, because he got very excited about this. We must have been making some noise on the sea ice because we saw these four things approach. At first we thought they were seals, but as they got closer we thought they're not, and next we thought they were dolphins, because we didn't really know. But then they came up and it was two mums and two calves, some sort of whale with very, very long beaks, and Jim thought they were Arno beaked whales, but I've never found out. I've looked them up, I've tried looking it up, but some sort of whale with a very, very long beak, very rare whale. But the great thing was they could obviously hear us, so they came to have a look at us. So they came up, and I remember these beautiful big eyes, you know, I don't know, not that far, 30 yards away, as they were coming to have a look at us and we were looking at them. And you know, that kind of interaction really with wildlife was just precious. In fact, I remember one time, this was something just for me, you know, and because everything you do, you're doing together, it drives you mad. You've got nothing to talk about because you've done everything together. But one time, coming back from the Met building, doing a weather observation in the middle of the day or something, perhaps it was like 6 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning, everybody else was asleep. And as I set off towards the, it must have been in the summertime, I set off towards the main accommodation building, when suddenly the snow erupted. And while I'd been at the Met building, a whole load of petrels had come in and obviously seen the buildings, perhaps thought we were mountains. I think they were on their way further inland to the Shackletons or something to nest. And they'd been on the snow. And they were white, so they were camouflaged. And I disturbed them. And this whole flock of birds just lifted off the ice and just went whew. And, you know, I went back to base and I didn't tell anybody because I wanted to have something just for me. So now, you know, it's there for posterity.
Tell me about the Millennium celebrations, because you were there when the millennium turned.
Yeah.
First of all, when did it turn for you? Because where were you in the time zones?
Oh my golly, now you're asking. I think we were on GMT for most of the year, but I think we then went on to GMT-3 in the summer season, so we could be on the same time period as Rothera. I think so. Yes, we did. So we had a kind of summer, you know, like British summer.
So the millennium happened for you 3 hours before it happened for...
Yes, I must have done.
Or 3 hours later.
Yeah.
3 hours later.
And we had a big party, so I don't have great recollection of what we got up to. But then we also took a photograph of everybody, which we would have gone on the base wall as well. So, I mean, obviously everyone would say this, but you know how every year you have a winter's photograph and it gets put up on the wall. So while we were there, we still had all these photographs, and I think we did a special one for the millennium as well, which was great, with everybody who was down there. But we didn't really do much. We didn't, apart from the party and the photo, we didn't really do... Oh, no, we had the flag, of course, because, you know, at the end of summer and the end of winter, we always raffled the flag out. But I think we did a special millennium flag as well, so somebody won the millennium flag. Possibly Gary Wilson, the chippy. He seemed to win all the flags, but anyway.
It was a time here for looking forward and looking backwards, and I wonder how much opportunity you had to contemplate those who'd gone before you, whether in 21st century Halley, there was any sense of the pioneers from the heroic era who 100 years ago made their first tentative footsteps on the continent?
While we were down there, I mean, at the millennium, it was the end of, it might have even been the middle of relief or the end of relief. I mean, it was such a busy period, it wasn't really a time for recollection. I remember we did most of our sort of recollection and thinking and during the winter time and at midwinter. But the library had a huge amount of books on Antarctic history, and we read lots of books about the past, and we also read lots of the old base reports, and we also had the old film, I don't know. You know, the old projectors with really old film I'm sure some of the old guys would know this anyway.
Reel-to-reel films.
So we used to watch that during the winter, and we used to learn a lot about the guys who were there. So we all read of Ice and Men and South and things like that, you know, Shackleton and South. But the other thing I was particularly interested in was the history of women in Antarctica. So I'd read a lot of books about that before I went and then when I went down there. So the first thing I'd read was Sarah Wheeler's Terra Incognita, which was brilliant. She'd had some hilarious experiences. She'd been down before women had been wintering it with the British Antarctic Survey. I think I was the third year or something that women had wintered. So she'd had a mixed bag of experiences. But then I was interested in other women. So the other thing I'd read was Antarctic Housewife by Nan Brown, which was quite a rare book. And she had wintered at South Georgia with her husband, I think, who was the comms manager. And that was a very poignant story because at the end I discovered that later on in life she'd committed suicide. I don't know whether that was related to her experiences in Antarctica or just the person she was, I don't know. But she spent some time in Antarctica. She used to have a pet penguin that she dressed up and things. It was very... And of course, going to South Georgia was very poignant. And who else did I... I mean, there weren't many stories about women in Antarctica. Not much. I'm trying to think of the other books now. I've got some of them at home, but...
You hinted at the fact that you were also a historic woman in the Antarctica, right? You're maybe 3 years on, but you were still a pioneer. You were one of the very first female winterers.
Yeah.
And did that generate any complications at all, either in physical, practical, or just in attitudes?
Because of the such a high turnover, obviously every 2 years you have a whole new set of people on base. I mean, some people had obviously been down one when there weren't women, particularly the summerers, but for example, the winterers was a whole new batch, so they didn't know any different. So it wasn't like the guys were sitting around going, oh, when I was, you know, So from that point of view, there wasn't any major problems. Some of the guys who'd been down doing summers and things would obviously, you know, Dave Routledge had been down loads of times, but he took it in his stride. He's very, as I said, he was very kind to me. There was a few, I mean, we had heard when we first turned up, we were told that the base commander, you know, before, who were the first women? It was Lucy and, I can't remember her name, but anyway, apparently the summer before they turned up, Les had gone around and pulled all the pornography off the walls. So apparently there had been some modifications before we'd arrived. Obviously, girls, Lou had been installed. And they said that we women had a civilising effect on us, which is great fun, on the base. Certainly, I was reading my diary on the train down here. I seem to spend an awful lot of my time ironing. The blokes just had no sense of kind of, you know, cleanliness or decorum. I remember, this is another one that I'll confess to. I remember my second winter, towards the end, the summers were coming back, and we'd got out all the duvets to go and do up the summer accommodation building. And I insisted on pulling all the duvet covers off and washing them. And some of the guys were like, oh, don't bother, they'll survive. I was like, I'm not putting dirty duvets back. So anyway, there was a certain level of...
Standards
that I think were raised. Oh, but some of the gear, some of the equipment was obviously male-orientated. I think I said in the notes that I was issued with underwear. My thermal underwear was for blokes, so it had a great gaping hole in the front for blokes to pee out of. So when I first got it, I stitched it up. So there was a few things like that, but...
I hope it wasn't passed on to a chap 2 years later.
I kept it. I wouldn't.
Oh, you kept it.
But some of the other bases didn't have women. So we used to play darts and things with other bases. And I remember in my second winter playing with Sanai, the South African base, which was all men. And I was on the comms reading out the scores, you know, for the darts match. Anyway, after about 20 minutes or so, I think I handed back over to Mark Ryan. And the guys at the other end of the radio were like, put the woman back on! They were obviously very keen to hear a female voice. So that was quite funny. So my first winter, there were two women. There was myself and Karen. And in my second year, Karen Shorey, the other meteorologist. Yeah. And then my second winter, there was three women. So that was
a world record.
That was a world record. So myself, Kat Gillies, the Steele director, Steely, and then Lil Ng, who was the doctor. So that was a unique one, I think. Three women. So still 13 men, three women, but nonetheless.
So how did that work in the sort of dynamics of the base? Did the women stick together, or did you form a little WI?
No, you know, I was trying to still think about this, but I mean, obviously you've got women and men, but pretty soon after after a few weeks, you stop being a woman and a man. You're just people, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're David and Kevin and Alex and Lil, and you get on with some people, you don't sort of get on so well with other people. You stop being, you know, I don't know, girls and boys. You just become those people.
Fids.
That you fit, exactly. And it's a very sort of...
So you didn't have any problems in that respect?
No. I mean, there was a few relationships down there in Antarctica. I'll give away a few secrets. And maybe that did cause... I don't know. Maybe that did cause some friction with the lads. But, you know, there was... I don't know. You're just busy getting on with it, really, aren't you? You know? And then we didn't really have any girl cliques. We did have all the girls go off the base. No, this was in my second year. This is funny. Steve, the GA, decided to... all three girls, we decided to go off on a field trip together with the GA, so the four of us left base, and we said to the guys, okay, you can do what you like now, you know, watch as much pornography as you want, trash the place, you know, I don't know, do whatever you like. Anyway, apparently, so we all went off base, and they apparently just completely behaved themselves, and somebody tried to stick a blue movie on, and it lasted about 5 minutes, and they turned it off again, so they were very, you know, we'd had quite a civilised effect exactly by that point, so... So I think we just... I think there's a lot of peer pressure on boys to be boys, isn't there? And then... Anyway, so...
A couple of little details then before we wrap up, if I may. You suffer from hallucinations.
Yeah, I did. This is on a field trip. I think I'd got a bit tired, very, very tired, and just dehydrated. And I just remember... my mind was going completely. I mean, ten out of ten to the lads who got me off the sea ice that afternoon, because I was absolutely knackered. It was Andy Cope mainly. He was the one who helped me get off the sea ice. I was in a right state. You know, sometimes you can just forget how dangerous Antarctica can be.
Mm.
Silly things like, I don't know, you go out in a blizzard and take the wrong step. One of the most scariest moments I've ever had in Antarctica was when we were camping down at the coast and in a tent, and I think I was with Ian Marriott in the tent, and there were the two others were in the caboose, and it got to about 10 o'clock at night and we left the caboose to go to the tent, and the tent must have been 10 metres away, if that, and there were some lights in the tent, but obviously, sorry, in the caboose, but not in the tent, and we set off from the caboose, and after a few steps, I remember looking back to the tent and seeing it glow, turned around, and then just saw that I was, you know, Ian in front of me, and then I couldn't see anything else because the wind was howling and the snow was blowing, and I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I hope he knows which direction he's going in, because, you know, a tent is not that big, and I thought if we miss the tent and we're moving away from the caboose, which has got the light on, that's it. You know what I mean? We could walk off the edge of a cliff. We could just die of exposure. And I remember suddenly my heart went in my mouth, and I thought to myself, you know, and literally about 5 seconds later, bang, we hit the tent. But for that moment of disorientation, when I just turned around and turned back again, I realised how dangerous it could be and how your life could just like that in Antarctica, you know.
Did that connect you back to the pioneering days, the heroic era? Because you were in a situation that they would have been in more regularly than you.
Yes, yeah. I mean, obviously health and safety was a big thing on base. You know, we were always carrying radios, always having to check in and out. If you went, you know, if you didn't report back, you know, I think based on experiences in the past, they were really strict about what you could do and how you travelled and all that sort of thing. So it was much safer than it was in the past. But still, a split-second decision. And, you know, I remember, I don't know who else you interviewed, but the year before, Karen, in fact, had quite a scary experience where she got lost between the main accommodation building and the balloon launching facility, and had wandered around a little bit in a blow, and then found one of the surveyor's measuring poles, thank God, rang up base, estimated the height of it, and they'd used the plan to work out where she could be, roped themselves up and eventually found her. But I just thought, God, you know, you can get lost 50 yards from, you know, from base. It just goes to show, doesn't it? You can see why now, Scott and everything, you know, you vaguely think, well, they're only, you know, a couple of miles away from food. That's, it doesn't take much, does it?
Tell me about the igloo.
Oh, yeah. So this is Andy Cope and Tiny Dave again, and decided to build an igloo, and we did it all wrong. So what happened was we dug the hole in the ground to get the blocks and then used those blocks to build the igloo, which of course is all wrong because you're supposed to have the inside of the igloo higher up than the outside so that the warm air stays in the igloo. Anyway, nonetheless, we built this igloo, and you know, it was quite big actually, it was really good. And I think they spent a night in it, and then I spent a night in it, which was great. Woke up covered in snow, it wasn't very windproof, but it was great because it let the light in, but it was soundproof. So I remember waking up in the morning, sticking my head out, finding the Nodwell crane was working about 20 yards away from me. But couldn't hear a thing. It was nice. It was nice to have somewhere else to go. Do you know what I mean? After a year, you've been everywhere, you've seen everything. It was nice to have a different destination.
Did you wind up at Rothera on a more regular basis, apart from that one flight? Or near Rothera?
No, after I left, I only went to Rothera for the weekend, and then I left Halley, and then on the following summer, I went to Rothera and did a season at a campsite at the bottom of the peninsula. So went to Rothera for a couple of weeks, then flew south, spent a month out camping, and then went back to Rothera and then flew out again. So
was that with BAS or was that a different organisation?
It was with the Antarctic Funding Initiative, which had literally just started, I think, that year, which was a way for universities in Britain to have more access to the facilities that the British Antarctic Survey had. So the government, obviously NERC, was giving a whole pot of money to BAS, but to set aside a little amount for universities to apply for. So UMIST, Physics Department, again, got in touch and got some money. So as I was leaving, they said to me, it was a joint project, in fact, between BAS and UMIST, said, would I be interested in doing this project out of Rothera the following summer? So I jumped at the chance. So I was, in fact, being employed by this AFI money, Antarctic Funding Initiative money, and working for UMIST Physics Department, which is a nice...
Was that a successful
circle.
Arrangement? Did that work nicely?
Yeah, it was good. We were running an ice nuclei chamber, which is basically a snowmaking machine. So I took a snowmaking machine to Antarctica. So it's great fun. So we spent 4 weeks out camping down there and doing weather observations, flying kites, getting snow samples, that sort of thing. Again, just collecting data for somebody at a later stage to use. But it was nice to spend a bit more time at Rothera.
You're now working in the museum
yeah.
business, and for the Natural History Museum, you actually ran an Antarctic exhibition, which I'd like to finish up on that, really. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so I'd been working at the Science Museum for a couple of years doing exhibitions. When I found out that the Natural History Museum were doing an exhibition on Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey for International Polar Year, which was a few years ago now. What was it? Must have been 2006, of course, 50 years after International Geophysical Year. So I applied for that job and got it, obviously, because I had exhibition experience and I'd been to Antarctica. So we did an exhibition, it was called Ice Station Antarctica, and it was basically aimed at families and kids to kind of encourage more children to find out about Antarctica and be inspired by it. So it was great fun. So I worked very closely with folks at BASS again. We had clothing on display, we talked about the science that they do, so geology and biology and a bit of meteorology. We did a sort of recreation of a base station, you know, the sort of beds and the comms and it's just a flavour really for people to get an idea of what it was like. But it's great fun working on it, and it went after the Natural History Museum, went off to Spain as well, so it's been touring.
And you wound up on Blue Peter.
I did. So to promote the exhibition and International Polar Year, I was invited to go on Blue Peter. So we set up a campsite in the studio with a pyramid tent, with food boxes, jerry cans, the lot, and myself and the presenter dressed up in do suits, roped ourselves up to each other and then walked on stage. They'd got some penguins from somewhere. I mean, obviously some sort of, I don't know, you know, South African or New Zealand, or no, what do you call them, Falklands penguins, you know, waddling across. And then he interviewed me and we talked a lot about Antarctica. So it was fabulous.
Which do you value most, your Blue Peter badge or your Fuchs medal?
Both are wonderful. Both are wonderful. So
were you gobsmacked about the Fuchs medal?
It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. I was so proud to receive it. I got it for Met and Morale. I can't remember the whole citation, but I think it was for my work on my dedication to meteorology, and then my work on for Morale, I suppose, was probably for the activities I organised. You know, I did Spanish lessons, Easter egg hunts. I organised I don't know, murder mystery nights, and I don't know, all sorts of daft things like that, just to keep everyone entertained. So it was delightful to get that. So proud.
It's been delightful to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.